I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Five of My Best with Steve Kilby from The Church. Now watch to the end because you'll find out his number one song. Now, don't forget to subscribe. It allows you to find out immediately when I upload a new video, and it helps me. Okay, here's Steve Kilby. Steve Kilby, five songs. I think for someone like you, this is probably the most impossible task ever.
Yeah, well, I gotta say, I just, when I saw you said pick five songs of yours, I didn't agonize over it. I just went boom, 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 boom. And as everybody always says, on another day, I would have picked another five, and the day after that, a different one. So it's a random five, but it's a five that I really do like. So, but it is hard out of that thousand odd songs to narrow it down to five. And I think, oh God, I've got a chance for people to hear something a bit different. So I guess that's the main thing that I think of.
Okay, let's kick off, because the first one that you chose was Aura from Priest equals Aura by The Church. And yep. What's interesting about this is that, in a way, you need to give a bit of back history. You know, two albums before was Starfish, the North American successful album, and the record company then want another similar album. So you come up with Gold Afternoon Fix. But on the opening track, Pharaoh, you say, hi to all the people that are selling me. Here's one straight from the factory. And in a way, this next album, and particularly this track, Aura, sort of reflects what happened to the band and to you after that.
Kind of, yes. Yes, I am. So it was a very, it was a bit of a cliched old story. We had some success. My first ridiculous reaction was to turn around and try and bite the hand that was feeding me by writing this nasty song and making it the first song on the record, erroneously assuming I was now such a superstar, it wouldn't matter. Do you know what I mean? Like, I was so huge and necessary to them that they would all just get over this sort of ridiculous thing about, hi to all the people who are selling me. Here's one straight from the factory. It was a really dumb thing to do. I wish somebody had said, you know what, don't do that. But anyway, I did. And then, yes, and then that sort of album, of course, they, you know, just Arista didn't really get behind it that much. And then the third album for Arista comes out. It's the kind of album I always really wanted to make. I don't know why I hadn't already made it. I guess the circumstances around the first two, it was a lot different. We were back in Australia. We had a Scottish producer who was a really wild kind of guy. And we sort of did what we wanted to do back in the And but I think we had absorbed some of the stuff from Starfish, and we'd matured a lot. We played a lot of shows, and we wrote some really good music. And the and yeah, I guess the lyrics are sort of, I don't know. I was, you know, with all of the songs, I'm a lot more on Priest Equals Aura. That was very, that was a very one-dimensional lyric. There's that lyric about hi to all the people selling me, here's one straight from the factory. It's like, however, on Aura, I like to think I got back to my usual measure of ambiguity. So it's kind of about the song is a lot more interpretable. And you've interpreted as the story of what happened after that. And that's a really good and valid interpretation, but it is that, and it's more than that. And you know what I mean? It's like, that's the beauty of music, that we always think about it. One song can be so many things. Like a newspaper article that says, you know, John Smith is no longer in love with his wife. That's the end of it. They're breaking up. That's it. That's the newspaper article. There you have it. That if John Smith writes a song about his wife and he's broken up with her, that song can have all the ambiguity and regret and longing and even joy and grief and all the rest of it. So exploring the sort of the ambiguity of music, I thought this was where I really became good at ambiguity with this album, with this song. Of course, historically, it was not a good time for the church, because in 1992, grunge was breaking out. Grunge, like punk before it a bit, gave the illusion that it was destroying everything that was around, and that it was like a sort of iconoclastic movement of simplicity and real feelings, tearing down the artifice of all the stuff that had started to grow up as new wave music had sort of developed into stuff like the church, I suppose, and all the rest of it. Suddenly grunge came along, and it's like, it's raw and it's wild, and it's played by people a lot younger than we were. I was 36 at that particular point in time, and the bands all coming through, of course, they were all younger and wilder and sort of dumber, you know, like every, you know, all, and we were, unfortunately, it's all swept aside by grunge, and the record was kind of wasn't really appreciated.
But is it where you found your absolute direction and what you really wanted to do?
Yes, it really was. Yes, where I really understood where I was going for the first time ever. I felt in total control of it. Which is funny, because we didn't manage another good record. I made so many mistakes. I thought, now I've done this one, I can do this one every time, but I couldn't. And I didn't. And also, I don't know if I'm allowed to mention this. This 1991, when we made this record, was unfortunately when I encountered opiates. Heroin and opium. And for a little while, I really shouldn't be saying this, for a little while, it gave me this fuel, and it gave me an ambition, and it gave me a feeling I wanted to capture. The honeymoon period, a bit like, you know, like for a little while, the benefits far outweighed the problems while I wasn't yet an addict. While I was just having it sort of casually, and it hadn't become a way of life, and I still had money, so I wasn't out, you know, hocking my bicycle so I could buy a fix. For a while, it gave me this a new feeling I wanted to chase, this detachment. I wanted to get this feeling of sort of that there was a lot of history and I understood what was going on, but I was detached from it, and to make the music feel sort of slow and the groovy, the way, you know, opium especially is a wonderful feeling. I mean, it's terrible.
But you mentioned that, but in a sense on the album, there's a paradox, which is about the effects of the drug, you know, and there's Swan Lake, which was sort of about neglect of your kids. So you did understand, in a sense,
the effect of the drug
as well, didn't you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I could. It immediately started becoming apparent. And that, yes, there are warnings. But I imagine some musician who is just beginning to get into the opiates could find this album and go, wow, look what it did for this guy here. Despite, you know, some warnings and stuff, it seems like it's all really flowing from somewhere. You know, it's coming on down. So, anyway, of course, like everything else, it's like everything, there's a good and a bad side, and I'm sort of wrestling. I'm wrestling with it all. I famously always say, I always resort to this, I wanted to reconcile everything. And I'm not exactly sure what that means, but that was my ambition, to reconcile all of the music and lyrics and great records and production techniques and everything, the Beatles and Joy Division and the symphonic music, Frank Sinatra, and sort of everything, dissonance and everything I could think of, and all the lyrics and all the songs that I'd ever loved, and all the books about magic and, you know, C.S. Lewis and all the rest of it. I wanted to get it all bang on this one record that was so... You didn't need to go any further after you'd heard this record. There it all was in one huge, there it all is, whatever that is. I had a stab at that, and that's what it is. And I will always have a really big soft spot for this record.
It took you 10 years to actually get off heroin, didn't it?
It did.
So was there a particular moment where it became clear that it had to end?
Oh, that moment was about 3 months in, when I first started using. All of a sudden, things began to happen to me. I would suddenly get really sweaty, and then I experimented, like, oh, I've been having this every night for the last 2 weeks. What would happen if I stopped? And then I'd stop. And I couldn't bear it. It was like depression and anger and sadness. And almost immediately, people were going, you know, if you're going to do this, I don't want to be around anymore. Sort of giving me ultimatums. That started really soon. People, they were trying to keep people away. Even making this record, there were sort of guys that couldn't get in the building unless, if I wasn't there, and these guys turned up, they wouldn't let them in. And I had to get them in and then yell at everyone, like, don't you not let my friends in. But of course, they were not letting them in for a reason. But for a brief time, I was inspired. And I can't, there was an Australian singer called Paul Kelly who said, people can't understand that in the beginning of heroin, in the sort of, in the honeymoon period, there's this incredible spiritual, there's this real feeling that, of course, it quickly vanishes when you become a junkie and you don't get it anymore. But in those early days, there was this feeling I really wanted to communicate musically and lyrically. The party line goes, I did that drug so you didn't have to, so I could make a record and you could put it on and you could hear and feel what smack was like without actually having to go out and fucking do it. That's kind of the idea behind it. Of that, I mean, very vainglorious idea, but I was. So as I discovered each drug in my life, I wanted to make music like that. Even if I didn't like it, I'd go, wow, this is a sort of a feeling I can try and get with music, see if I can bring this feeling out somehow.
All right, let's go to number two.
Okay.
When you think of falling, yeah. Speed of the Stars, from Speed of the Stars as well.
Yeah.
And this was with Frank Kearns. And
you
met Frank Kearns, I think, sometime in the 80s in Australia, hadn't you?
I met him at a gig. The Church and his band Cactus World News were booked to do a gig somewhere like Connecticut or Vermont, and we didn't hit it off at all. The two bands didn't hit it off at all, and there was no one there to see us, and the whole thing was kind of an angry and aggressive thing. And then later on, I was really surprised when I was doing a gig in England about 10 years later, and this guy came up and said, "Hey, Steve, I'm Frank from Cactus World News." And I was like, "Well, I thought you hated me." And he's like, no. And then I went and stayed with him, and we drove around Ireland, and I sort of knew a bit about Irish mythology, and I'd gone through a Celtic mythology thing where I was reading a lot of books about Cool Culain and Finn McCool, and I knew the four provinces of Ireland, and I was really into it. And so he drove me around, and he showed me a lake where there was a monster, and we went over to see where people surfed in off the coast of Ireland, and we drove all around, and we became friends, and then we made this record. Unfortunately, in the beginning of the record, the heroine got in the problem. That when he met me, I was on a brief. When he met me in the 90s, I was on a brief remission, and he met a normal me, and then we drove around. I stayed with him, and we got on really well. But then when I went back to make the record, even though I smuggled a load of it in there with me, I used it up pretty quick. I had absolutely no, it was like asking a cat to look after your goldfish. It's like I had no, nothing could stop me just using it. And then I ran out and I got really sick. So we had all this music we'd started and never finished. And we stayed friends throughout the years, amazingly. And then finally he came over to Australia and said, "Come on, we've got to do this." And he came over a couple of times, and I sang it, and we put more instruments on, and then we wrote some new songs as well. And yeah, this is from one of the new songs, "When You Think of Falling." It's not one from the original session in the 90s. It's one from in about 2014 or something. So yeah, it's me and him, and I do the vocals and write the words and play bass and keyboards.
But this is the mention of Icarus in the clouds, isn't it? This is this yes. one.
Yeah. Icarus in the clouds, flying around so proud.
What do you think?
Oh boy, he's got it made. Oh boy, please stay in the shade. Yeah.
What do you think when you work with someone? What do you think they learn from you?
Well, they can learn all my recording techniques, and they can see Grant McLennan. When Grant McLennan from the Go-Betweens and I made a couple of records, I learned from him that there is still very much a place from guys just picking up an acoustic guitar and sitting down, strumming the first chord and go, "I was walking down the street on the..." And suddenly there's the whole song and they're playing the chords and writing the words bang on the spot. That's what I learned from him. From me, he learned that you can start off with a little noodle. You can start off with the smallest thing and then keep building on it and building on it and building on it. And eventually you've got this sort of whole backing track that you couldn't have written the other way of just sitting down with the guitar and singing. I think that's the thing they sort of learn. People learn from me the way I approach recording, and I'm very cavalier, and I sort of work intuitively, and I know it's a real cliche to say this, but I treat the recording studio like an instrument to play the studio, like having the faders going up and down, like you're moving your fingers up and down on a string or something. And I did a lot of time on my own in my own little studios figuring it all out. And I have my own kind of methodology and sound and approach that I use. I imagine that's what they learn from me. I don't think anybody else. Everybody does everything differently. Everybody sees stuff in a completely different way. That's the amazing thing about music. You sit down with five musicians and you start talking about a piece of music, and you realize everybody within that five-man group is seeing this piece of music in a different way. Some people are thinking about the melody. Some people are thinking about the drum beat. Some people are thinking about the production. Some people think about the words. Other people are thinking about the general effect. Other people are thinking, is it different enough from the other songs, or does it sound like something else I know? Or is it a downer, or is it an upper, or is it too puerile? Or, you know what I mean? So everybody, nobody has, it's like a jumbo jet. They say there's not one man on earth knows everything that happens on a jumbo jet, on every part and every part of the jumbo jet does, and all its mechanics and all its, you know, all its levers and wires and screws and nuts and bolts and things. No one can know all that. And I think a piece of music is like that. And I have a very narrow sort of thing that I do with music, but I really know what I want to do. And I think my greatest strength is I can very quickly spot something good. I can hear a phrase go past just once. So we can be jamming. I can be jamming with someone for 20 minutes. And we're jamming and jamming. I go, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then suddenly it all aligns, that jam aligns. I go, stop. Okay, roll the tape back to that spot there. And they roll back and there'll be a little thing in there that I go, that thing there is what we need to work on. And it always seems to be like, if I hadn't have said that, nobody else in the room would have noticed that little thing go past. That's what I'm really good at, spotting potential in something. That's my main kind of job.
You mentioned like interpretation in your lyrics, but there's clearly, you know, metaphors which allow that interpretation as well. And if we look at your third choice, Pangaea, which is from Untitled 23. The 23rd album, The Church, of course. I mean, it's clearly, for me, I'm going to say what my interpretation, but I think it's pretty clear on this one, really, the metaphor of the continents being together, which was Pangaea, breaking up is then the metaphor for the breaking up of interpersonal relationships.
That is totally valid. And that's the first time it ever occurred to me. And like, I would never say that isn't it. I go, wonderful. That's a new interpretation that I wholeheartedly embrace. And whatever someone's interpretation of that was, if it feels good to me, I'll go, yes, that's what it is. But in another way, that isn't it at all. It's like, and, you know, usually you don't get to ask these questions about songs. If you love a particular song that somebody does, you very rarely, unless you're maybe you, do you actually get to meet this person and go, hey, what is that really about? Normally, you just have to go, I think it's about this. And
it stays, you know, at that. So, hey, what is it really about?
It's not, look, I'd have to say, if I say it's not about anything, would you look down your nose at it more? If I said, I have left this so open, I wanted to have a song where the verses were like Bob Dylan. So I'm singing like Bob Dylan. I'm singing like, you got your hand on my heart. You got my hand round your throat. You better jump on the clock. And then suddenly, in the chorus, it jumps out of that into the Beatles. And I just needed a word. I just needed one word. It's like, and what the word that came to my head was Pangaea. And there it is. And then the songwriting spirit and everybody around goes, yes, that works. That's it. You've cracked the code. And then you put the song out. And then years later, people all around the world go, this is about breakups of relationship. This is about the breaking up of a continent. You know, this is about, and really there was no, like an abstract painting, there was no, it was there to be whatever people wanted it to be. But sometimes in the early days when I used to say that, when I used to try and explain, and they go, oh, this song's about you breaking up with a girlfriend. And I go, no, actually, And they go, what is it about? And I go, well, it isn't really about anything. And they go, oh. And then they'd feel like a fool. And then they'd be like, well, I really was liking this song and now I found out it isn't about anything. I feel like I'm tricked. So
well, no, because,
be really
okay.
Careful.
Yeah, no, I get that. But I mean, you know, when you look at Bowie's cut-up technique, and I know that, you know, you were a massive Bowie fan, and I was as well, still am. And that the cut-up technique, obviously what that facilitated as well was multiple interpretations. So in a sense, this is, you know, this is in a sense why your songs are so loved by so many people, because they can put themselves into the song.
Okay. First, I agree and thank you. Let me say this. When I watch films of Bowie doing the cut-up technique, boy, he's feeding them some good words. Like, you know, he's introducing this random element of chance into the whole thing, but boy, oh boy, he's choosing the words to cut up and reorganize. He's not, you know, he's not just cutting up the an article about a racehorse. You know, he's got beautiful things in there. So when it is cut up and recontextualized, he is still the guy who chose all of that material to be cut up and recontextualized. I do much the same as him, except I don't actually have the paper and the cutting up. I just do the cutting up in my head. I need a syllable here and I need a word here. And sometimes, just like Grant McLennan showed me, I sit down and the engineer says, okay, today you've got a song. He puts the song on. He says, the singing's going to start here. 1, 2, 3. And often I can just go, yeah, well, I was walking along. And then suddenly the words, the sort of the first lot of words come out. And then I'm on the trail of the song, and it all sort of sequentially downloads. Sometimes I get completely stuck and I do, okay, time for a cut up. I'll just take it always amazes me how you can have a song where the chorus has absolutely nothing to do with the verse. You can't do that in many other art forms. In music, you can. You can have a verse that's like this, and then suddenly the chorus come along. It can be a different time, different key, different singer, and the words could have absolutely nothing to do with what you just heard and what you hear after that. And yet, if it's a really good song that's done well, the listener will put it all together. And when the listener puts it together in their own way, they will come up with some fabulous interpretation that will really delight them. And then they'll go, wow, isn't Steve Kilby a great songwriter? He's made me feel like this. Actually, it's their great interpretation. I've just given them some words to work with. And then when they figure it all out and they come up with what they come up with, they attribute it to me, but it's really them as well. And I really like that. I like that idea of bringing the listener in. I'm not saying, listen, this is how it is. The world's like this. And it's going to be like this. And this will happen. I'm like, imagine this, you know, like one of those guided meditations. You know, can you hear the sound of birds? Do you see water? You feel very relaxed, don't you? What would you like to do now? I'm sort of like that. I'm trying to sort of draw you in and then say, hey, you can go wherever you like with this song. And consequently, most of my songs, happily or sadly enough, aren't about any.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Okay, let's move on to the next song, and it's from Hypnogogue, which has become an incredibly successful and lauded album, and the track is Antarctica. Why did you choose this?
Once upon a time, the church went in the studio and jammed for 50 minutes. And when we all sat down, we went, phew. The last thing anybody ever wanted to do was hear that 50 minutes again. Not then, nor ever. And everybody said, yeah, I'll wade through it. Oh, no, I'll have a listen to it and sort it out. I'll do something with it. I'll figure out. But nobody ever did. And it sat there for a long time. It was just called a long jam with the minutes, 58 minutes, 19 seconds written at the end of it, defying anyone to wade through. And that's an hour of your life, Steve. How many hours you got a day just to sit down and listen to a piece of music that's an hour long and then go back and, I mean, even just right there, it's a one-hour commitment at the very least just to even listen to it all. So what I did, I sat down with an engineer and I said, I like this bit, I like this bit, I like, we listened to it all the way through. I put in the hour, I like this bit, no, yes, yes, no. I said, okay, cut that up for me into a bit of shape. And he took the bits I liked. I went outside and smoked a joint and looked at the scenery. And then I came back inside and this very clever geezer, because sometimes these geezers are great because he cut it up the way he wanted to do it. He didn't have any preconceptions. He was working for me. And I said, cut that all into shape. And he cut it up. And when I came back in, I was determined that however he cut it up, that's how it would be. That's what it would be. And I did. And he sort of started off. He took all the drums out of it. So all the time there's drums and bass playing, but at the very beginning, he's taken the drums and the bass right out. So you just hear this very unusual thing of about five guitar overdubs all just churning away at each other, like it was meant to be like that. It sort of starts with one going, and then another one, oh. It all made sense when there was a drum kit and a bass punctuating this and showing you what it all is. If you take that out, suddenly you've got this sort of free-form beginning. And then when the drums and the bass do come in, it's really powerful doing what they always did. And then he just cuts them, and then the song completely changes tack halfway through and turns into a sort of bluesy, swampy kind of thing. It's gone from a New Order-y thing into a sort of bluesy, swampy, well, I was out there. And then at the end, it turns into this very fragile, strange little pop song, which is on the dark side of town, you take the easy way. Turns a bit into just like a Bee Geesy singing, very melodic. And I just love within that one song reconciling these three things. And Antarctica, it's such an exciting concept, I reckon. It's like begging to be described by music, like the beauty, the sleekness, the coldness, the purity, the whiteness, the strange animals, the weather. It's defying. John Cale had a beautiful track called Antarctica Starts Here on an album called Paris 1919. And he whispers at the end, Antarctica starts here. And so I'm kind of picking up from where he left off, trying to, and then I've woven it into the story. You know, there's a book now, don't you, Steve? I've actually written the book that ties the Hypnagogue and its offshoot album, Erosita and the Perfume Guitars. There is now a book that you can get, and it explains all of this. He's living in Antarctica because Australia has been burnt to a crisp with bushfires and climate change. So his parents leave Sydney, and they moved a lot of Australians and people from all around the world are migrating to Antarctica because in this brief sort of warming, Antarctica's turned into not a bad place to be. At least there's no more bushfires, you know. It's so cold and drizzly, but it's safe. And you could imagine all these Australians that have just been battling bushfires for 20 years, just can't handle it anymore. That's when in the book, his father says, I'm not handling this anymore. When we started making this album, Australia was being ravaged by terrible bushfires in 2019. There were 1 million native animals dying every day. And Sydney was black. There were cinders falling from the sky. Friends of mine, 200 miles down the south coast, were sending me snapshots of 11 a.m. in the morning. The sky was black. And they were all standing on this beach. Talk about between the devil and the deep blue sea, why their houses burned. And they've got their backs to the ocean. And if the fire was to come down onto the beach, they're going to walk into the sea. And they're all watching some people's houses randomly burn while others, the fire would just, my particular friends who were down there, the fire, for no reason, ignored their house and burnt the one down. The one in front of it, the one behind it burnt down, their house was untouched. So sort of that's all become mixed up with the music. And the Australians have gone to Antarctica because they can't handle any more fires. And our boy, the hero, Eros Zita, he lives in Antarctica, and he writes this song about Antarctica. He thinks it's groovy.
Why do you think some artists stagnate and that then you are someone, you know, you mentioned earlier, there's this whole history of music which you can delve into and be inspired and maybe take things from. And then there are other artists who stay in their lane and stay in their track and they seem to stagnate, but it's something that you could never say about Steve Kilby.
I hope not. I really appreciate you saying so. And this year, in the last year, a lot of people, after a lot of work I've done and just keep plowing, going, doing what I do, writing stuff that I write, doing all these collaborations, releasing all this music, touring. In the last year, people have started the magazines around the world and people started, audiences are going, wow, this guy's really, he keeps on keeping on. He doesn't sit back and, you know what I mean? So I'm really glad that I hear you say this. And I'm always hoping for this late minute revival in my fortunes at the age of almost 70. I'm hoping to be sort of like the way Leonard Cohen turned it all around. He was only 56 with I'm Your Man. I'm hoping to turn around, people suddenly go, wow, this guy's really, he keeps on trying all the time. You know, we go to these other places and they're all just knocking out the same old stuff. But Steve Kilby is like actually using his experience and his knowledge and his love. He's still in love with what he does. I don't know why. It's like the sailor who fell from grace with the sea. Some musicians, I met a very famous musician the other day. I can't say his name. And I was doing this package tour in the Philippines, and there was this very famous, successful guy. And I started to talk to him, and he said, let me put you straight. I don't like music. So don't think I'm going to talk to you about how much I like music. I just do this to make money. I really like doing this other thing that he did, which was building ships. All right. So I'm like, wow. It really, like, you think at my age, nothing would disillusion me. I sort of staggered away from there, like, that's really sad, because I love this so much. I always have. A lot of things distracted me. Fame or lack of fame, women and drugs and money and egos and arguing. All those things sort of distracted me. And now I'm sort of down in the home run. I'm just concentrating on music and writing and art and stuff. And I'm bearing the fruits of all this. I'm enjoying the fruit of all my labor, is what I should say. I've worked really hard. I still love it. And I try really hard. I don't ever dish up the same old slop, not for a long time. If you buy one of my records, you can be sure it's intelligent and it's literate and it's got some experimental features and it's made with a lot of love and a lot of craft, and the people I collaborate with and the people who engineer it and mix it and the people who do the covers, and now even the people who release it, which in the UK is Easy Action, we're all fans. All the people I work with, everybody, they're all fans. Even my new management team in America, they're
even
fans.
A new band, in a way, you know, like the people that you've got in your band, where, you know, that you, because some left, and then the new people you got, they're also longtime fans, aren't they? They're ones that knew you.
Yes,
you know.
Yes, they're fans. Yes, they're fans of the church, and they're fans of music, and all of them, we still listen to a lot of music and sort of talk about it and argue about it and explain to the others what we like. And yes, they are now. Three of these guys are a lot younger than me. And when they were teenagers, they were very enamored by the church. And now they're actually in the damn band. They don't go, oh, you know. Like, it's easy when you're in something and you've always been in it. And you've been in it since the age of 20 to go, oh, Jesus, you know. But these guys are sort of, they love being in it. And when we play and when we rehearse and when we write, that the love and respect all comes out. So I'm in a really, for this brief time, this brief Indian summer of my life, I have a lot of experience. I know what to do. I know how to write songs. I know how to produce records. I know what's good and what's bad. I'm sort of living it up, making as many records as I can while the sun still shines.
Well, one thing that underscores what you just said about really doing the unexpected and changing from one album to the next, if we take the last track, Where Gloria Meets Rachel from 11 Women, I mean, if one album took years, maybe 4 years, Hypnagogue, and then this one was 3 days,
yep,
in a studio. You know, there can't be a bigger difference between these two. So why did you choose that track, Where Gloria Meets Rachel?
Well, it's just coming out in England. It's just coming out on Easy Action Records. And this is an example of starting out with the most simple thing. And it's a little guitar lick that goes, diddle-a-ding, 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 diddle-a-ding. Record 4 minutes of that. Just this guitar, go diddle-a-ding, diddle-a-ding. And then come back with another guitar and go diddle-a-ding, diddle-a-ding, diddle-a-ding. And then gradually you put some chords into it, make it, you shape it, and then put random instruments through it. Like, it's very much like a Tomorrow Never Knows or Blue Jay Way. It's very much invoking the Beatles. I'd say with the Hypnagogue, we have, for example, we have almost absorbed and outgrown all our influences. David Bowie is very prominently an influence of the Hypnagogue in the singing, but the music, no. The music's almost like, it's pretty much, you know, it all comes from somebody else at some point, but we've covered it all up and sort of absorbed it, and now we're spitting it out. And it really is the church. Nobody but the church could have made that record. However, with Gloria Meets Rachel, this is a track that's like, wow, I really love this period of the Beatles when they did stuff like this, and they had sort of sitars and cellos and backward cymbals. And there was never enough of that. They moved on too quickly and onto their next thing. But for me, there's a lifetime of inspiration to make one of those kind of psychedelic songs, like a real sort of, you know, weed song, a song to smoke dope to and put the headphones on, hear everything go, and sort of, and the lyrics are this sort of vaguely philosophical, but nothing heavy. It's like, it's just ear candy, psychedelic ear candy. I'm having fun doing it. It's like a sort of song, every overdub I kept. Like, I didn't sit down and figure out what I was going to do. I just go, right. I play in 3 days, the whole record was made. I sat down with the drummer and I went doodle-a-doo, doodle-a-doo, and he just played along. And then I go, right, give me a new track. And whatever happens is that's it. And then the same thing again. whatever I play, whatever I do, if I get someone else in to do something, whatever they do, I say, this, whatever you do, that's going to be it. You're not going to be in here trying to do it for hours. And then I just take the first take of everything and keep it really fresh. And, you know, in there you could hear me counting. Well, I was actually, that counting wasn't supposed to be in there. It was just to let me know where the next verse was going to start. But then it sounded great miles off in the distance. We're going 1, 2, 3, 4. You let the whole thing, all the accidents, and then you have guys, you know, you muck around on percussion, and it's just supposed to be as trippy as you can possibly get it. No great, nothing behind it other than that. Whereas the Hypnagogue has sort of more of an ambition of sort of like laying a bit of a thing on someone. This is a concept record. This is a story. This has sort of emotions. Where Gloria Meets Rachel is just a kind of a, it's just something groovy, just for the sake of it, like a daydream.
I think what's interesting when people choose five songs, it's not necessarily what they put in, but it's what they leave out. And I think people who know you and the Church in passing, of course, they always think of Under the Milky Way. Has that been, or was that ever, the noose around your neck?
It's like, it's a noose around my neck that sends me a big check every 3 months. You know, it's like, it's that's my thing to reconcile. It's like the devil said, do you want a hit song? And I said, yes. And he said, you're going to fucking hate it sooner or later, but it's going to make you a lot of money. And I said, all right, I'll take it. I'll take it. And now, yes, I hate it. I hate talking about it. I just, you know, like when people come along and film my show and I play for 2.5 hours and then that's the song they put up, which on their Instagram page, there's me doing Under the Milky Way. And, you know, it's like, all these songs I've written and people just talk about this one song. Yes, that's a blessing and a curse. That's duality. That's a first world problem, Steve.
Yeah, we like first world problems.
Yes, we do.
Okay, the five songs. Aura, When You Think of Falling, Pangaea, Antarctica, and Where Gloria Meets Rachel. Got a number one?
I think I would say, at the moment, I'd say Antarctica. When we were playing this on the last tour, there was an incredible feeling when the guitars start up going, and then suddenly I look at the drummer and we both kick in, and it was a truly triumphant rock and roll moment, sort of like this missing ingredients, and suddenly there it is, and the bass is pumping and the drums are hammering. It's just a great rock and roll moment. So I have to say Antarctica, definitely.
That's brilliant, Steve. I've got to say one thing at the end. When the last time I talked to you, and this time when I talked to you, and I talked about what other people glean from you, and you talked about the studio, but for me, it's your creativity and your energy and this vitality that really is the ability to transfer it to someone else. And I have to say, apart from doing this podcast, next month I'm writing a book and I'm writing another screenplay. I'm taking a month off and I'm having my Steve Kilby moment as well. So thanks, Steve.
That's amazing.
Thank you so much.
Good luck with that. And you know what? Persevere and do something every day. You just sit there every day, get the book out, get the screenplay out and do something. That's my advice.
Brilliant. Steve, listen, thanks so much and good luck with all your ventures in the future. And I will see you again, I hope.
You will, Steve. You're an absolute legend. You really are. I'll see you later.
All right. Bye. See you.
Bye, mate.
Up there is an interview I recommend. Down there is where you can find all the podcast interviews. And here is where you can connect.